John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, December 13th, 2011. Settlers launched several attacks against Israeli military and Palestinians across the West Bank, and four homes are demolished in nearby Bethlehem area. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. Extremist right-wing Israeli settlers broke into a closed-off military zone in between the West Bank and the Jordanian border, at the site thought to be where Jesus was baptised. The protesters say that they are sending a message to the Jordanian government to stay out of Israeli affairs. This is a reference to the statement made by Jordan's King Abdullah on Monday that he hoped Israel would choose not to demolish a bridge in Jerusalem. The attack occurred at the Jordan River, on the closed military zone separating the West Bank and the Jordanian border, and both Jordanian authorities and the Israeli army have stated that the Israelis did not cross the border, but were approximately only a few hundred metres away. In other settler news, approximately 50 extremists from the Hilltop Youth Group staged multiple attacks on Israeli military and Palestinians alike. They broke into the Ephraim Regional Brigade's military barracks near the northern West Bank city of Qalqilia, hurling rocks and Molotov cocktails. Several fires were started and numerous vehicles were damaged. A group also stoned military vehicles, injuring the brigade commander, who received a stone to his head along with several of his men. The same group, comprising around 100 settlers, also attacked Palestinian cars travelling on the main road near the settlement of Ramat Gilead. The string of attacks comes as tension mounts over the impending dismantlement of numerous illegal outposts within the West Bank by the Israeli authorities. The settlers in question claimed that Israeli Defence Minister Ehud Barak is responsible for the escalation and claimed that Barak, quote, discriminates against the settlers and their settlements, unquote. In other news, Israeli troops arrived in the town of Beit Jala near Bethlehem and proceeded to demolish four homes belonging to local Palestinians. The residents have been prevented from entering their lands in the area since the homes are located near the tunnel linking Jerusalem with the Etzion settlement block. They claim they received no demolition notices or orders from the so-called civilian administration. Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported on Tuesday that two Palestinians, including one child, were injured after the Israeli army invaded an area east of Al Buraij refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. The High Committee of Medical and Emergency Services in Gaza reported that a 48-year-old man and a 14-year-old child suffered moderate injuries and were moved to the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This is the Tuesday, December 13th daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by George Rishwawi and me, William Gibson.
Pakistan, Sunday. Unknown fighters burn NATO oil tankers stranded in southwest Pakistan for the second time in less than a week as Islamabad warned it could enforce its blockade of the U.S. lifeline to Afghanistan for several more weeks. One of the truck drivers was killed. Pakistan, last Thursday, at least 32 oil tankers and 10 containers were burned by groups of armed men on Thursday. The trucks were carrying fuel and military hardware for NATO forces stationed in Afghanistan. The attacks in Pakistan are on convoys trapped by the closure of the border with Afghanistan to U.S. convoys. This closure is in response to the death of 24 Pakistani soldiers in a U.S. airstrike on a border post at the border with Afghanistan. Iraq, ongoing. Camp Ashraf, home of hundreds of Iranian dissidents known as the MEK or People's Mujahideen, is threatened with extermination by Iraqi security forces as soon as U.S. troops leave. Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki is Shiite, and the MEK fears he has allied with Iran. Yesterday, supporters and relatives of people trapped in Camp Ashraf protested in front of the White House as Maliki met with U.S. President Barack Obama. An earlier massacre at Camp Ashraf by Iraqi troops left dozens dead, and far worse is now feared. The U.S. calls MEK a terrorist group, but MEK abandoned the armed struggle against a theocracy in Iran a decade ago, and the U.S. continues to call them terrorists for fighting a regime also regarded by the U.S. as the same. If the State Department would remove the terrorist designation, resettlement in a third country would be possible, but so long as this designation remains, Camp Ashraf residents are expecting deportation to Iran, followed by execution. Iran, ongoing. Iran is showing off the U.S. stealth drone they captured. They say they hacked into its electronics and landed the drone with minimal damage. The government of Iran claims that will soon be able to put this drone into mass production for themselves. Baghdad, Iraq. U.S. President Barack Obama says the war is over, but tell that to Baghdad residents living near any liquor store. Yesterday, four civilians were seriously wounded when unknown gunmen opened fire on a shop selling alcohol in central Baghdad. Fallujah, Iraq. Yesterday, gunmen using silenced weapons and a bomb attacked a minibus carrying judges near a police checkpoint, killing three people, including two policemen and one civilian. Five others were wounded, including three judges and two guards in central Fallujah. Iskandara, Iraq, Saturday. Three rockets landed in or near the U.S. military's Khalsu base near Iskandara, 40 kilometers south of Baghdad, wounding three people living near the base, local police reported. Tell them that President Obama says the war is over. Mr. Barack Obama, put some truth into your statement that the war in Iraq is over. Remove all the troops, all 17,000 contractors who are staying as supposed security for the U.S. Embassy, and make arrangements for peaceful resettlement of Camp Ashraf residents. Only then will the war in Iraq be over. Do the same in Afghanistan. Bring all the troops and all the mercenaries home today.
A confluence of recent events has dramatically increased tensions between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Western nations. The early November release of an International Atomic Energy Agency report, presenting evidence that Iran had been developing a nuclear warhead over the past decade, while also working toward long-range missile capability, provoked calls for more severe economic sanctions. A massive explosion at an Iranian solid-fuel missile testing site on November 12th, destroying the facility, has prompted speculation that this blast, and another at a uranium conversion facility in Isfahan, could have been the result of a U.S. or Israeli covert sabotage operation. The November 29th Iranian student invasion and trashing of the British embassy in Tehran moved relations between the two nations to the breaking point. The embassy incident was followed by reports on December 4th that Iran had shot down a sophisticated U.S. stealth reconnaissance drone over Iranian airspace. In response to these events and the reported earlier assassination of four Iranian nuclear scientists and a computer virus attack on the nation's uranium enrichment program, Iran's Revolutionary Guard announced that they have raised their readiness level to confront potential external airstrikes and covert attacks. While Iran has long maintained that their nuclear research program is for civilian energy production only, both the U.S. and Israel have in the past threatened to launch airstrikes to derail what they believe is a drive to build nuclear weapons. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy, who assesses the risk of a military confrontation between Iran and the West as the U.S. presidential election campaign moves into high gear.
In analyzing particular events, there's a lot we don't know. You know, there's an explosion in Iran. Why was there an explosion in Iran? Who knows? Could have been an accident, as the Iranian government itself is saying. Could be the result of an Israeli or U.S. Covert operation. We don't know. Tensions have been increasing. The Senate just passed on a vote of 100-0 last week, legislation requiring the president to impose broad sanctions on Iran's central bank. This is a major escalation of the sanctions. Remember that at the beginning of this conflict, there were sanctions on Iran's nuclear program. Now, the Senate, under the leadership of Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, who introduced this amendment, now the Senate is really pushing for attacking Iran's whole economy. And Senator Kirk has been quite explicit that his goal is to destroy the Iranian economy, make the Iranian people suffer. That's his goal. So this is a major escalation. We've got a Republican presidential campaign going on now, and some of the candidates, particularly the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, has been very aggressive in his rhetoric about Iran, talking about a military buildup, having a military option with Iran. And this is also happening in a context where we, again, as we've seen so many times before, in the run-up to the International Atomic Energy Agency's report, there were again threats from Israel to attack Iran. This is a pattern. It seems every time the issue of Iran's nuclear program is on the international table, then there are these threats that Israel will attack Iran. And it seems clear that, and in fact this is often openly stated, that the Israeli government's goal is to pressure Europe in particular to agree to whatever sanctions are being proposed. And so the Europeans, in a way, that are being threatened, not Iran, by Israel's military threat. Because, of course, there would be significant economic and political collateral damage for Europe, in particular, also the United States, the Obama administration has said, if the Israeli government were to attack Iran militarily, the Iran could respond by closing the Straits of Hormuz, for example, through which the majority of the world's oil passes. This would be a huge disruption in the world economy at a time when, you know, already the world economy is quite fragile. So, yes, there is an escalation going on, not just in the present, but with some indications about possibilities in the future. You know, imagine if Mitt Romney becomes the president of the United States in January 2013. We see a war with Iran, would be more likely to see a war with Iran then. Many of Romney's advisors are people who served early in the Bush administration and were cheerleaders for war with Iraq. So, yeah, there are a lot of troubling signs with respect to the potential for military conflict with Iran.
Are there actors within the Obama administration that will do their best to avoid a military conflict with Iran going into this very dangerous year of saber-rattling around the U.S. presidential election? Or do you think the country could find itself in a new conflict in Iran in the next 12 months?
Well, I think both those things are true. I think that the administration does not want war with Iran and is not trying to push the U.S. towards war with Iran, and instead is trying to pursue this policy of sanctions and, you know, possibly covert action on Iran's program. However, those policies are dangerous in the sense that the more you escalate the sanctions from, you know, narrow sanctions to broad sanctions that are really attacking the economy, and the more you do things, nobody knows who's exactly doing this, but whether it's the Israeli government, the U.S. government, but things like assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, the more things you do like that, the more you run the risk of an Iranian retaliation, which then might provoke U.S. or Israeli retaliation, and so on and so forth. So the things could escalate out of control, even if it's not the goal, which I don't think it is, the goal of the Obama administration to have a war with Iran, but it is the goal of the Obama administration to dramatically increase pressure on Iran, possibly with the goal of regime change.
Robert, along with conservative politicians in this country that want to use foreign policy issues as a cudgel to beat up Barack Obama in advance of the November 2012 election, there is some thought that the Iranian hardliners benefit in some way from confrontation and even airstrikes or attacks on the country, in that the nation is quite divided in terms of a lot of opposition to the mullahs and the fundamentalist government there, and that an attack on the country would stoke nationalism and distract people from any kind of internal dissension going on?
Well, I think there's no question that escalation in the external confrontation benefits hardliners in Iran and benefits the government at the expense of civil society and democratic space. And this trend is well known. I think it's not an accident, and many people think it's not a total coincidence, that the protest movement in Iran in 2009 happened in a context where there had been a de-escalation. So the beginning of the Obama administration, Obama came in talking about diplomacy with Iran, made some positive gestures. People in Iran stopped believing that the U.S. was going to attack, or the attack on the U.S. was imminent, that increased political space because it decreased the ability of the government there to rally people against the threat from the United States. Just the escalation of the climate of confrontation constricts the political space in Iran.
That was Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. Find more analysis and commentary about the rising tensions with Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. It's been a little over 10 years since the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., but new legislation now making its way through Congress has the imprint of similar bills that were hastily passed and signed into law in the fearful days following the nation's most deadly terrorist assault. The House and Senate have recently voted to include a provision in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act that mandates that all accused terrorists be indefinitely imprisoned in military rather than in the civilian court system. But most alarmingly, the measure also empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens suspected of engaging in terrorism without charge or trial. Although many civil libertarians have been critical of President Obama for not thoroughly repudiating many of the Bush administration's harsh, extra-constitutional methods of dealing with terrorism suspects, the White House, along with the Secretary of Defense, the directors of the FBI, CIA, and National Intelligence, have all publicly come out in opposition to the indefinite detention provision, saying that they are both harmful and counterproductive. But some observers believe the Obama administration's objections have more to do with preserving executive branch power rather than opposition to the substance of the legislation. Your reporter spoke with Chris Anders, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why his group is opposed to the indefinite detention legislation and are urging President Obama to veto the measure.
This is an amazing bill, and unfortunately a bill that's on a very fast track, going back to both houses of Congress and being sent to the president's desk. Here's what's in it. There are a couple of provisions in it, in the bill, that allow for the indefinite detention without charge or trial of people picked up far from any battlefield. And this would be the military being the ones who would be imprisoning people. And it's so extensive and so broadly written that it even applies to people picked up within the United States. It even applies to United States citizens. And so the result of this could be, and it could very well be, that within the next few weeks, this president, any future president, could have the power to order the military to indefinitely detain, imprison American citizens and others picked up here in the United States, picked up in friendly countries like Canada, Great Britain, elsewhere, put them in military prisons without any charge or trial based on suspicion alone. And so it's basically anyone that would be suspected of having any kind of relationship with a terrorist would be able to be put into military detention without charge or trial.
We have seen President Obama take onto himself extraordinary powers, where he's ordered the assassination of a terrorist suspect in Yemen, al-Awlaki, just over the last month or two. And there have been other targeted assassinations abroad. How does President Obama's current power, which he accords himself, relate to this legislation? I would imagine it strengthens his hand to do exactly what he's been doing all along and that George Bush before him did. But it's interesting that his administration is opposing this legislation.
Yeah, well, one of the things that the Obama administration has said repeatedly throughout this year is that they believe that they have all the detention authority that they need. And certainly they've claimed a lot of detention authority, a lot of authority to do a lot of things around the world that a lot of people, and certainly we at the ACLU, believe that they should not be doing. The difference here is two things. And one is that this broadens out who can be detained and implicitly also broadens out who it is that we're at war with. And it delinks the war authority from 9/11. So this is no longer about going after the people that committed that horrible attack on the United States. This is about going after terrorism suspects and people who support terrorism suspects and people who allegedly support terrorism suspects anywhere in the world, including within the United States. And that's a big difference.
Tell us a little bit about the motivation. Why is this happening now? It seems to have a lot to do with election year politics and posturing, especially, you know, among legislators who are up for election in 2012.
Well, that's a million-dollar question. Why now? I mean, certainly it's more than 10 years since 9/11. The United States is pulling out of Iraq by the end of this year. Combat troops will be out in Afghanistan. The government is trying to figure out, Obama administration is trying to figure out how to get out of Afghanistan. I think probably right now as quickly as they can. And Osama bin Laden, of course, is dead. So why now? I think that really it's a couple different things. And one is it's the Republican takeover of the House gave this a little impetus to get this passed on the House. They finally felt like they had the votes to do it there. But then you also have a couple members of Congress, particularly senators, who have two different worldviews. One is there are people that just view this as a good partisan issue, and they just want to try to embarrass President Obama or embarrass other people and try to say, well, you're not tough on terrorists if you aren't willing to lock up even American citizens. But then there's another group of people, including people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who have this view that the United States is at war everywhere and that the war on terrorism is not like war on poverty, where it's some kind of metaphor. That it really is a war, and it's a war everywhere and against everyone. And if you have that worldview, it kind of makes sense. Well, maybe we should start using the military in the United States. Maybe we should start using the military against American citizens. And certainly, why don't we start locking people up before they do something? But that, of course, is not the way the United States operates. It's not the way our Constitution operates. It's not the way we as a people like to view ourselves. And so it's a very dangerous worldview, and this bill is a real fight for the, I think, really the very soul of who we are as a people and who we are as a country.
That was Chris Anders, Senior Legislative Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Find links to more information and articles on terrorism, the Constitution, and the rule of law on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. On the 12th of December, thousands of Occupy protesters blockaded the West Coast ports. The ports of Oakland, Portland, Longview, and Vancouver in Canada were shut down, and the port of Long Beach in Los Angeles was partially shut down. This blockade had the effect of severing corporate America's lifeline to the sweatshops of Asia for one day. Here's what Clarence Thomas, a longshoreman in Oakland down at the docks, had to say about the blockade.
Morning. My name is Clarence Thomas. I'm a third-generation longshoreman. I am the national co-chair of the Million Worker March movement, which has endorsed and supported the Occupy movement. Quoting from Harry Bridges, "Something special happened in the spring and summer of 1934. Maritime workers who had been considered little more than ignorant roustabouts took history into their own hands. They built a powerful new movement from the ground up, waged a complex and bitter strike along the length of the Pacific seaboard, and conducted the only successful general strike in the country's history. They proved that they could win and win big. Their success stimulated hundreds of thousands of other workers to organize. In the long run, they raised the standard of living of nearly every man, woman, and child on the coast and created working conditions which became the envy of millions of workers in the rest of the nation. One of the real contradictions that took place in 1934 during that great strike was that black people, by and large, were prevented from working on the waterfront. The only time we really had a chance to work on that waterfront were as scabs. Harry Bridges and other militants of the left of the Longshore Union realized that they could not win that struggle without the support of the black community. And what Bridges did was to go to black churches and make an appeal to the black community to stop crossing the picket line and to join it. And in exchange for that, blacks would be included in the ILWU, which is one of the reasons why I'm standing in front of you today.
At Long Beach, protesters had to duke it out with riot cops to enforce a partial closure of the harbor. Same day as the West Coast port blockades, Occupy Wall Street laid siege to the headquarters of Goldman Sachs in New York City. Goldman Sachs is an investment banker that is a major beneficiary of sweatshop labor, as this makes its investments in firms like Walmart more profitable. In fact, H.B. Scott Jr., Walmart's PR man for most of the past 10 years, is about to quit his new job at Goldman Sachs after his work reviewing Goldman's practices in the wake of the Abacus lawsuits. After Occupy Wall Street protesters stormed into the lobby of Goldman Sachs on the 12th of December, at least 17 were arrested. Outside, somebody had this to say about the notorious Goldman Sachs.
Today, December 12th, is National Day of Action in solidarity with Oakland on the West Coast. They're shutting down ports. They successfully shut down their ports this morning. And we were doing a solidarity action here in New York at 200 West Street at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs. One of their subsidiaries, SSA, owns the ports over there. And so we were doing an action to raise awareness about that.
We came for a march to Goldman Sachs in solidarity with the West Coast Occupy movement, which has organized a port shutdown for today. And as I understand it, the owner of at least some of those ports is a subsidiary of Goldman Sachs, which is why this was our target.
I certainly think that, you know, they certainly should not be paying a lower percentage in taxes than their secretaries. I don't think they should have offshore tax havens. I don't think they should be able to commit fraud and get away with it without punishment. Nobody else in our country can break laws in such a way. And I don't think criminals should be rewarded with bonuses and carte blanche to bribe politicians and pass whatever laws they want.
We just heard that Portland succeeded in shutting down their port, and that the longshoremen in Oakland are not crossing the line.
In the weeks to come, Goldman owns a lot of properties all throughout New York City, and there's a phenomenon called squidding that they might want to look out for.
The squid connection is that Matt Taibbi, a few years ago in Rolling Stone, wrote about Goldman Sachs being the, let me see if I can get the quote directly, it's like the great vampire squid wrapped around the face of America, jabbing its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. And so we decided to run with this idea and fight the squid.
Vampire squid indeed. Goldman Sachs, through scams like a Bacchus, is sucking the blood out of retirees who invest in their traps and stealing from the whole country. It's about time people blockaded harbors and the offices of the investment banks so we become the choking octopus and we get to stand on their air hose until they pass out and lose their grip on our wallets and our public funds. Several Occupy DC protesters are on a hunger strike demanding statehood for Washington, D.C. Yesterday, the hunger strikers, supported by more of Occupy DC, occupied the offices of Congressman Harold Rogers, demanding that there be no social riders against D.C. in the upcoming federal budget.
But I can't beat all the powerless when my cup's already
today, Occupy DC and the hunger strikers blockaded GOP House Speaker Boehner's office.
But it's on the table, the fire's cooking.
When the Capitol Police asked if they were trying to get arrested, the answer was no. Instead, they were demanding to meet with House Speaker Boehner in person. Meanwhile, Congressman Issa is whining about the effect of Occupy DC's campsite on McPherson Square on grass. The protesters occupying Boehner's office responded that they want to know why $400,000 was ever spent on park renovations in a rich neighborhood shortly before Occupy started, given that there is so much poverty in D.C. After 45 minutes, maybe more, it was reported on Twitter that protesters were in the hall outside Boehner's office, still refusing to leave the area. Occupy D.C. is asking people to call 202-225-0600 to demand statehood for D.C. or at least budget autonomy and no social riders against D.C. in the 2012 budget. Repeat, that phone number is 202-225-0600. This song goes out to
To all you goons at Homeland Security, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and police organizations that are trying to attack Occupy camps all across the U.S. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly, too. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich takes them for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them be kicked. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping mall just to pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too.
California Representative Henry Waxman has served in the House for 36 years and says he's never seen such assaults on public health and the environment as are happening this year in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. Waxman, who chaired the House Energy and Commerce Committee from 2007 until 2011, is now the ranking Democrat on the panel. He says that this year alone, Republicans have introduced 170 bills to weaken environmental laws, especially the Clean Air Act. The latest is Bill H.R. 1633 that Waxman says purports to be about regulating dust on farms, but actually exempts major industrial polluters from the Clean Air Act. According to Waxman and other critics, the measure allows open-pit mines, smelters, cement plants, coal processing plants, and other industries to emit unlimited amounts of particulate pollution, which include arsenic, lead, cadmium, zinc, and mercury, among other toxic substances. During committee debate on the measure, Democratic members offered amendments to preserve the Environmental Protection Agency's role in regulating industrial pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals, and the EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. Both amendments were defeated by the GOP majority. The bill comes up for a vote before the full House during the second week of December. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Representative Waxman, who says that while he expects the legislation to pass in the House, he hopes the bill will be stopped in the Senate or by a presidential veto.
The Republican-controlled House has been the most anti-environmental in the history of our country. They have voted 170 times this year to weaken our environmental laws, and the Clean Air Act has been the target of the most attacks, with 61 votes to dismantle the act. This has continued the efforts to block actions to address climate change, to stop actions to prevent air and water pollution, to undermine protections for public lands and coastal areas, and to weaken the protection of the environment in dozens of other ways. This week in the House of Representatives, we're going to vote on a bill that's very popular because it's going to prevent the regulation of farm dust, and people who come from the agricultural areas say their farmers are scared to death that EPA is going to regulate the farm dust, which is so natural. People walk around or have horses or whatever they do on the farms. The only issue is, however, that EPA has insisted they have no interest in regulating farm dust. And that doesn't make any difference to the Republicans. They want to pass a law to prevent it. But the real underlying reason they want to pass this law is because they're also going to remove regulations from the pollution containing arsenic and other heavy metals and to stop EPA's authority to control air pollution from open-pit mines. They don't talk about that, but what they are really going to do is to allow toxic pollutants. Toxic pollutants are pollutants that cause cancer and birth defects and other neurological problems, and they're going to stop regulation of these dangerous pollutants from mines, smelters, cement plants and coal processing plants. So this isn't just stopping EPA from regulating farm dust, where they don't even regulate farm dust and they don't intend to regulate farm dust. It's really not about farms. It's about letting industrial polluters off the hook for cleaning up their pollution.
So the vote is coming up this week. Is it a foregone conclusion how it's going to go?
So far, every vote that's been on the House floor, the Republican majority has prevailed in passing the most extreme anti-environmental position. They even took a bill that came out of our committee and made it worse on the House floor. They struck the goal of having standards for air quality that would achieve health outcomes. And they struck that from the requirement of the Clean Air Act, which has been the essential part of the law since 1970. And this is just like so many of these others. They've passed the House, where the Republicans control the majority. So far, the Senate has not acted, and hopefully they won't take these proposals up. But nevertheless, Republicans have them ready to go if they can trade them away for something in the Senate and force the president to sign very, very bad environmental laws. But I hope they won't get away with it.
How can they force the president to sign a bad environmental law? He can veto.
Well, the president can veto, but we have bills that are must-pass bills. For example, before we leave this year, we have to pass a bill to fund the government for the next fiscal year. The president, of course, has insisted that we continue a tax break for Americans on the payroll tax. And Republicans say they want to do that. Democrats say they want to do that. There's a problem on getting the way to pay for that tax break, to continue it. And the Republicans are looking to see what they'll find acceptable. They don't want to raise anybody's taxes, particularly for the upper income. But in the whole mix of things that have to be done, they can slip in some anti-environmental provisions and see if they could get the president to swallow them, because that may be the only way we keep the government going. I don't think they're going to get away with it. I think the president's going to stand firm, but we've got to make sure that he does and make sure that the Senate insists that these kind of riders on the bills be dropped.
Henry Waxman, how long have you been serving in Congress?
I've been in the House for 36 years, and I've never seen anything like we're seeing this year, where there's no restraint on the Republicans' ability and desire to wreck our environmental laws that were set up to protect the public health. If we let arsenic and lead and other toxic pollutants go right to the public without using control technology that we already have available to us, we will be sentencing people to very serious health disasters, not just kids who have asthma, which is bad enough, but inducing diseases like cancer and other respiratory problems.
That was Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. For more information on congressional debate over the deregulation of industrial polluters, visit our website at btlonline.org.